What's in the fest bag this week, Robert?
My boyfriend has started working from home one day a week. The way he speaks to his colleagues has been a bit of an eye-opener that's making me reconsider our relationship. Why, just today I've heard him say the phrases low-hanging fruit, synergy, proof in the pudding, and extra bandwidth.
Comments include, can we circle back to this once we've established a sustainable paradigm shift in deliverables?
Oh, thanks, Better Call Paul, for that comment. Is there any phrases you find annoying, Dave?
There is one phrase I find particularly annoying, actually, which is whizzy.
As in, like, WYSIWYG or something, like it's the 1980s.
That's exactly it. No, Mavis Beacon teaches typing. No, it's it's when people come over and they say, can we have something a bit whizzy? Can we make it a bit whizzy? And what they mean is they want you to do a lot of work, but they don't really know what they want you to do, just to put in a lot of effort. And then at the end of it, they can sort of lie back like a Roman emperor and say, not like that.
Oh, God, yeah. So you're basically getting a very indistinct brief at this point.
Yeah, it's the worst kind of briefing where it's just like, can you just put in a lot of effort and make me look good?
What it reminded me of was like, I found the other day that I was personally getting blamed for those terrible compound swears that people say. All that wank puffing stuff. And I've never said that nonsense in my life. I mean, OK, I did say 20 years ago, I said kangaroo spunk. That was the one time. But that was way before wang puffing.
I might lay compound swearing at your door as well because of the swearing xylophone.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's what had kangaroo spunk in it. Was there any other compound swears in it?
Xylophone buggery and stuff. But it's not quite the same thing, is it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's not twee.
It wasn't twee. It was horrible and mean and evil. That's what it was.
That guy who wrote The Wire, who's always doing that kind of thing.
He does compound swears. So what?
I stopped following him shortly after Trump got elected because he got so furious.
He was going, Trump, the wank puffin all the time. Was that all he tweets?
It was like that. They were much angrier compound swears. But because it was part of a sort of wave of compound swears going round, it was like a fuck cromulent.
I quite like that guy. And I didn't realise he was a compound swearer because he's been in the papers this week or in the press this week for getting annoyed about AI writing, and everyone was cheering him on. But you know, if he himself is just batting out compound swears, AI could do that. It could do it better.
That's what he's worried about, isn't it?
All you need is like a list of animals and a list of rude words, and you randomize them. You don't even need
if marmoset.
Yeah,
if marmoset equal asshole marmoset.
Exactly. You've made your own wire simulator. There's your Remy, Dave.
That's what Omar used to say, wasn't it? His catchphrase.
You've got to re-up my marmoset arseholes. This is Fessel. Cue the jingle. Welcome to the Fesshole Podcast, where Rob Manuel and Dave Stevenson take this week's most terrible confessions and cringe at the horror of it all. I'm Rob Manuel, and I've been running this Fesshole account for 5 years.
And I'm David Stevenson, and I get dragged into Rob's projects, regardless of whether I want to or not.
And we've been friends since 1980.
Regardless of whether I want to be or not.
Our producer tells us we need to encourage listeners to subscribe, rate, and review wherever they get their podcasts. Dave, where have you been getting your podcasts recently?
Out of my bottom.
How many podcasts you got up your bottom, Dave?
All of them.
They're very compressed.
MP3s, Rob.
I'm so old, I remember MP2s. That's a true fact. There really were things called MP2s. In 1995, I was sharing KLF MP2s on the Wolverhampton academic network.
Which is the precursor to the internet, folks.
It was called Janet, and then it was called Super Janet.
Super Janet!
Yeah, it was the joint academic network, Janet, yeah.
This is like the shit Avengers.
Super Janet was even faster. What else we got going on, Dave?
As a matter of fact, my family's away on a cruise.
There's no one in your house.
There's no one in my house right now, which is why it's been so quiet and no one rustling around looking for things in the background.
Fucking hell.
But yeah, they've gone on a 2-week cruise.
Nice.
So it's exactly what you say if you've murdered your family. I'm hoping to get at least 2 weeks leeway.
So why is your wife going for a cruise without you?
It's not a good cruise.
It's not a sex cruise.
It doesn't stop anywhere. It does eventually stop, obviously. Otherwise, it would be a banishment.
It's just a barge. I mean,
it's what it is what's called a repositioning cruise, where when a cruise finishes and the season changes, they move the cruise ships to somewhere else. You can get a room on that for very cheap, but it doesn't stop.
That's very, very Sian, isn't it? She's zeroing in there on this amazingly, slightly odd, but a very amazing deal.
It's both extremely cheap and also she can potentially lobster all day, every day and have a butler. It's ridiculously cheap, but because it doesn't stop, it just motors across the Atlantic. And
she's stuffing you and your child with lobsters.
But I looked at it and it looked nice, but it also, Westfield looks quite nice, but I wouldn't want to spend like 2 weeks on holiday in Westfield. So I didn't go.
Can I tell you what I've got to look forward to, which I'm quite excited about, is I'm going to see Harry Hill on Thursday night.
Oh, that guy is great.
I don't live in Muswell Hill, but I live adjacent to Muswell Hill, and there's a pub there called the Village Green. And there's a guy who puts on this series of comedy nights there, and he books incredible people just in this pub. And so we've got Harry Hill this month. Last month we had Al Murray. And like, I always make sure I get the tickets early because it's only like maybe 150 people can fit in this damn place. So you get these like really big names in this tiny place. It's great. And he was necking booze all the way through it. I mean, I was slightly worried the amount of lager he put into himself, which I think it is character work, but it's real booze. It is going into him. You know, it's like... And this week on Fess Hole, we've invited in Chris Atkins, the noted lag, prisoner, author, filmmaker. He did Star Suckers, which was like a film which was an expose on the celebrity news interface that demonstrated tabloids would print any old rubbish without checking. He made the KLF film, which was extraordinary, Who Killed the KLF, which made me want to take lots of illegal substances and make really bad and exciting art. He went to jail for a bit of tax trouble, but it gave him a bit of a blag that he could do, which is write about going to jail. And he wrote a bit of a stretch, which I listened to an audiobook, and it was fantastic, having Chris whisper in my ear all about what was going on there. And recently he's made a film for James Blunt and the second book, Time After Time, Repeat Offenders, The Inside Stories. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Rob. Thank you so much for having me. I'm, like any right-thinking person, a huge fan of Fess Hole.
Thank you very much. I typed the word prison into the unpublished archive of Fess Holes, and it got 66 pages of
stuff. It was a lot. You sent it over and said, can you read all this before the podcast?
Yeah.
I was like, I don't think there's enough minutes in the day if I don't sleep to read all these mental tweets you sent me.
They haven't even been tweeted, these ones. This is unique content.
Oh, this is unfiltered.
Yeah.
God, it's like peering behind the curtain, isn't it? I think what it must do to the mind, being Rob, who has to sit and actually read all this stuff, day in, day out.
Every day I wake up and I have to read this document and it's sort of like, it's like, what are you doing, Rob? What are you doing? And it's like, I'm reading someone's sexual fantasies about Rishi Sunak and deciding whether it's okay to publish this or not. You know, someone...
You're like in your own prison. You're in your prison of Fess Hole, aren't you?
I am. And I think the Rishi Sunak one was sort of along the lines of this guy saying how it ended up with him saying... He wouldn't
mind. Can I just say I don't want to know? Can
okay,
I just say?
Great, wait, fine.
Wandsworth is bad enough, but this is like...
Tell me about what you found in that document.
I haven't been through like all of it, obviously. The first one I saw was someone who said, I was in a crack commando unit sent to prison by a military court for a crime we didn't commit. We probably escaped from a security stockade to Los Angeles underground. Today, still wanted by the government, we survive as soldiers for fortune. And if you're... younger than a certain age, that will make absolutely no sense whatsoever. But if you're old farts like us, you'll suddenly think, oh God, of course, the A-team. So that sort of, that set the tone, really, of everything else that came afterwards.
Just thought, no, this is bullshit,
But what came up actually quite a few times was, it was people admitting that they'd done a bit of time.
Yeah.
Earlier on in their lives, and then they'd sort of completely move past it. And they're still slightly haunted by it today because they haven't told anyone. And I think that's why they think it's fine. That's why they want to come to Fess Hole and sort of put it there, because it's a safe space where they can admit it and not be kind of identified and shamed. And I think that speaks to something that's quite important about the whole prison debate, which is the sort of the level of sort of shame and stigma that people feel having gone through the process, that they just, even 30 years later, for something quite minor, they still won't tell their wives or their kids that they're involved in that.
That's interesting, isn't it? It's something that people just don't talk about. They don't want to bring it up.
No.
Just think about the odd person I know who's been jailed. And it's always been a bit like, shh.
If it was for something like child abuse or something, you could understand why someone wouldn't want to bring it up at the dinner party. But if it was for joyriding or something in 1987.
Yeah.
People still have that sort of, the shame of that hanging over them, which I find really interesting. So a lot of the festhole things he sent me were a kind of people offloading on that. And that resonates with me because people do that to me. Because I've been to prison, they think they can tell me because I won't judge them.
But you do judge.
But I do, at like events when I do like book talks or
yeah. It's
even stuff on my films, which are nothing to do with prison, people come up to me and say, I don't tell anyone this, but I did a bit of time. Or they say, my brother did, my brother Nick from a post office. And we just don't talk about it as a family.
The superpower this has given you, people confess to you.
Exactly.
They've done porridge, yeah.
They've done porridge. And I'm like, oh, okay, that's fine. And it's like the statistics on this are quite interesting, that there's more, at any moment in time, there are more children who are affected by having a parent in prison than there are affected by divorce.
What?
Well,
what? But divorce is like, isn't like half couples get divorced or even more than that?
But during their period of childhood. During the period of childhood. Yeah. So it's a massive thing that just is not talked about. And I think that, in a way, makes a lot of the problems associated with prison and criminal justice much worse, is because there's this kind of wall of silence around it.
In a sense, then, prison itself is bad, but it's the kind of the stigma attached to it that means you have to hide a huge part of your life away, and that's kind of the real pain.
Yeah, whether it's jobs and relationships and housing, I think are weirdly the ones that people are sort of most scared of it screwing up. And I can totally see that because I spent a lot, especially this new book, time after time, I've spent a lot of time hanging around ex-offenders or in some cases current offenders, and that fear was very real for them, that someone was going to find out and they would lose a job, they'd lose a house, they'd lose a relationship as a consequence of it.
So for you personally, could you take us back to the first night you were banged up? And like, what? How did that go down?
It's not the response people expect. The overwhelming sensation was one of relief. And that was more because I'd been through the trial process as well. And the trial, I always say, was much worse than prison. So the trial was much more traumatic than prison. I've been back to the prison I was in. I've been back to Wandsworth several times to visit people there. And I've done like interviews for ITV News, standing outside when Daniel Khalif escaped. I visited lots of other prisons. I won't go back to the court. I was thinking about today, actually. I still haven't been back to the courtroom while I was sentenced. That's still too tough. So that's just to explain to you, it's not after sympathy, I had to do something wrong, but it's to explain to you how awful the court experience was, that actually then when it was all over and I was sent to prison, it was a big load off my shoulders. Even though I'd got 5 years and I was going to spend 2.5 of that in custody, I remember lying on that bed in my first night going, well, thank fuck, the trial's over.
So the court was bad because it was like a judgment on you kind of thing?
Yeah, it was very judgy. It's very humiliating. It's very public. And you're not in control of anything. It's like all the worst psychological things you can do to someone. There's zero control. You have more control in prison than you do in court. And it's the uncertainty. You do not know what's going to happen. And the weird thing about prison is prison has at least got some certainty to it. Like, you're going to be here for a certain amount of time and then they're going to let you out. It's going to be a bit boring and shit, but you're probably going to be okay. So there was more certainty. When I was in there, I thought I knew my fate. There's a line that people quoted from The Usual Suspects, where they say you have 5 suspects and you lock them up, and the one who sleeps that night is the one who did it because he knows he's been caught and he relaxes. And at the time, I thought that's almost too clever, but I remember thinking that was absolutely bang on because I did sleep. I slept really well for the first time in weeks when I first went to prison.
So I remember seeing you, and it was literally like a couple of days before you were banged up, you know, and I had no idea any of this stuff was happening. And we bumped
into...
I bumped into you in the pool in Archway with your son, and I was with my son. And we had a little chat. And then 2 days or 3 days later, you were jailed. So that was all hanging over you at that point.
And it had been for a number of years. Tax trials aren't quick. The time between arrest and the trial was 4.5 years.
Wow.
So by the time it was done, I was like, thank fuck, that has stopped. That part of my life, a significant part of my life where I've had this hanging over me, is now over. And I now know what I've got to face. And the result is the worst possible conclusion of that. Like, I've been found guilty on all counts and I had a pretty tough judge, but at least it has stopped. And that was better than not knowing what was going to happen. And I saw that a lot with other people who were on remand. So remand is when you've been charged. So they, you know, you're going to go to trial. And the point between charge and going to trial, you're kept in prison because you're deemed a flight risk or you're too dangerous. So for serious violent offences, people are normally remanded. Or if they're a big drugs kingpin and they're worried they're going to run away. I was on bail. I could go home during my trial. But there was a lot of remand prisoners in Wandsworth. And I would get to know them during their trials. And they'd come back having been found guilty and been given 15-year sentences with big smiles on their faces because it was over and they knew their fate. And instances of self-harm and suicide and mental health problems are much, much higher for remand prisoners because of the uncertainty.
Yeah, I was following I won't go into the detail of it, but I was followed a trial of an acquaintance and it took 2.5 years between the incidents and the actual sentencing.
That's not uncommon. And now, with me, it was a very specific thing. My trial was in 2016, because it was a very complex tax case. There was about 15 defendants. It was 4 different trials. It was just a huge mess. Now the problem is, like, everyone's like that because of the defunding of the justice system. But the defunding bit, it's like, God, if I thought the courts were defunded, you wait till you see the inside of the prison system, and then that really... The defunding of that is on a whole other scale. And that was, again, something I remember very vividly when I kind of went into Wandsworth, was it was just like stepping back in time, like to see things that, you know, hadn't been repaired or fixed for sort of decades, which you're just not really used to seeing in the UK. You know, we complain about public services, but you know, imagine getting onto a bus from the 1970s. Do you see what it, and it's like that going onto a prison wing. That's how kind of chaotic and sort of collapsing the whole system was.
So you're in a cell on your with another person?
Sharing, yes. Yeah.
Okay. Did you get on with that?
Well, I had a few cellmates and I was quite lucky. My first one, funny enough, was straight out of Porridge. He was sort of in his 60s and he was an old-time drug dealer, but he was from the East End and he'd been in and out of prison loads. So he knew the score. He knew how things worked or didn't work. And he was really good to me. He could see that I'd just tumbled down this rabbit hole, rabbit in the headlights, just having not a clue what's going on. And he kind of took me under his wing a bit. Then my next cellmate was a guy who I'm still mates with to this day, but still message each other. It's a guy called Martin Dodgson, and he was the former managing director. Dodgy Dodgson, of course. That's what I called him. He was the former managing director of Deutsche Bank.
You can
look him up. He was done for inside trading. I aimed high in the land of white collar criminals to share cells with, but I got on with them. You know you're with these guys for a long, long time, so you need to get on with them, and you keep each other going. It's good to have company. When I got to open prison, I got my own cell for the first time. I got my own room, and I didn't like it because I didn't have anyone to talk to. I kind of went a bit mad at who I am.
So just coping with the boredom, like what do you do to cope with the boredom? Obviously, there is talking to your bloke in the cell, but
there's talking to the bloke. I mean, most cells have TVs. Which the officers really liked. And the Daily Mail gets very upset about tellies in cells sometimes.
But it presumably keeps them quiet.
They're like, please, their telly's fixed. Someone please fix this bastard's TV, otherwise it's going to kick off. So
it's like giving iPads to children also.
It is. Yeah. Honestly, the infantilization of prisoners is really interesting. You've hit the nail on the head. Yeah. And there's so many like crossovers in terms of how prisoners are treated like children. And then that's why they can't, when they come out, and that's what my new book's about, when they try and reintegrate with the world, they can't because they've had everything done for them for 4 years, and then they're suddenly chucked out into the big bad world.
So boredom, we've got talking to your cellmate, telly, what's the next one?
So I wrote a lot of letters. I was inundated with letters when I got in, and I would write back to people, and that was great because it took up a lot of time, and it was very therapeutic, and I kept a diary. That's not really correct. I wrote down what was happening on random bits of paper because I didn't have a physical diary. They confiscated my notebook when I went in because I thought I might use it as a weapon. You know, words are a weapon or something. So I became a magpie. So whenever I passed anything that had some scrap bits of paper, I would just grab the paper and stuff it down my trousers so I could write notes on it, like my diary, which is what became a bit of a stretch, my prison diary. But I got lots of jobs. I worked. I became a real kind of screwboy, as they called it. So I did loads of jobs for the officers and the education department, and anyone who asked, I would help them because they were so short staffed, they were so under manned. They needed sort of vaguely intelligent, educated prisoners to sort of help them keep it going. So I just became the screws bitch, really, and just did loads of things for them.
I remember you saying about how you were doing those prison jobs, and one of them was prison listening.
Yes. Yes. So this is where our worlds collide, Rob and I. We become a kind of, become a funnel for people's darkest confessions. Listeners are basically Samaritans, but in the jail. So it's a scheme run by the Samaritans, and it runs in pretty much every prison in the UK. And they take trusted inmates, and that was kind of me, I guess. And we did a month's training with the Samaritans in the jail. I'd go to the library every week and get this training. And then I would get a T-shirt saying, listener, green. And then I got a better cell, and it meant that a couple of times a week I'd be on shift for 24 hours a day. And anyone else in the prison who was feeling suicidal or was self-harming or just depressed or having a really bad day could hit their emergency bell in the cell and say to the officers, Gov, I need to see a listener. And they were supposed to facilitate that. And they would take me and this often quite disturbed individual, and they would lock me in a cell with them. So I'd get locked in a room with them and I'd hear their confession, basically.
Sometimes these people would be in a sort of violent state or something, maybe. Or...
pretty much, yeah. I mean, literally foaming at the mouth. And most of the time it's people with mental health problems, having some kind of episode. That was the most common thing, really. They just needed to sort of speak to someone or engage with someone, and they weren't getting the mental health treatment that they needed. And so the listeners were just the last resort, really. The power of the confession is very, very important for people, just to offload. And people feel better once they've got off their chest.
Yeah, just saying things out loud, you know, even without the word confession, just talking to your partner or whatever, saying what the problem is.
And it is that whole thing of a problem shared, problem halved. And sometimes there are people who are genuinely suicidal. Sometimes it was people whose wife had just written them a letter saying that the relationship's over or their kids weren't coming to see them anymore.
Wow, that's tough, being dumped in jail. That must be common as well.
Yeah, it was quite common. I mean, some guys were pleased. Some guys were like, oh, thank God, you know, it's a terrible relationship. I've been looking for a way to end it. So that's good. Here's the thing, like, technically, you weren't supposed to give advice. If you know the rules, the Samaritans, it's like, it's non-judgmental. You're not giving advice. You're just there to be a sounding board, asking open-ended questions so people can come to their own conclusions. That's the theory. But sometimes it would be kind of glaringly obvious. And a lot of the time, it was people who'd just been bounced into prison, didn't know which way was up, had no idea how the system worked or didn't work, and were just stuck in their cells, going out their minds. So I would say to them, as it happens, I'm also the education orderly, so I can put you down for a course in, I don't know, dry lining or bicycle repairs, and I can get you on that course, and that will get you out of your cell three times a week. And trust me, that will make life easy. Don't worry if you're never going to repair a bike in your life, but that means that you'll get out of your cell, you'll have some human interaction and start to chat to people. So I'll put you down for that course. And then they would think, oh God, someone's finally listening to me. I mean, they might fill in the form and the form would go in the bin or something, but at least you were trying to give some help. You were using their first name. You weren't screaming at them or threatening them, which is what pretty much everyone else was doing. So a lot of the time, people were really nice to me afterwards about it. People come give me food or things because I'd help them. So it was the most worthwhile thing I've ever done. I wouldn't go back to it. I did about 6 months of that. It was really traumatizing. And the word trauma is banded around a bit too much, but I saw people like trying to kill themselves practically or self-harming and stuff. You know, you see a lot of bloodshed. But I'm glad I did it.
And this job is solely done by prisoners?
Yeah, it's a peer support thing. And I think it works with other prisoners because it's, look, dude, I've been in your shoes. Like, I know what it was like in that first week. It was fucking awful. It all gets slowly better. Like, the prison's the only thing where it starts off worse and just gets better throughout. And most things are always good at first and then drop off. I was like, look, it's going to be okay. You know, time passes quickly here. You know, you could give some kind of words of comfort that if it came from an officer or one of the prison staff who were 24 and were doing it because they wanted to get something interesting on their CV, they're not going to have the same level of connection that we had.
Yeah, what sort of people were the prison guards then? Were they, like you said, were they all quite young then?
Very young. There was a really interesting shift while I was there because as part of the great austerity drive to slash the prison budgets, they let go a lot of the longest serving officers. The longest serving officers I initially were terrified of because they were all ex-army. They were all like huge bald heads, you know, tattoos on their knuckles, 18 stone. You would not mess with them. But actually, once you got to know them, they were great because they were very funny. They knew how the system ran. They were pensioned off because they were seen as too expensive and replaced by 19-year-old kids whose only experience of authority was maybe captaining the school football team or being a librarian. And they were given 9 weeks training and given a set of keys and sent onto a wing with a load of unhinged nutters. And they absolutely, it's like Sir Robin, you know, they shat the pants and ran away half the time. And the turnover was astonishing. So these kids would come on for like a few weeks and then they'd vanish, never to be seen again. The staff turnover was about 50% at one point when I was there. I saw from, like, later I did research, I saw the statistics, like half the staff were all quitting within a couple of months.
50% in two 50%. Months?
50%. Yeah, yeah. It was something like that.
As a listener, you must have heard quite a few things, but are you allowed to talk about those now that you're...
The rule is absolute confidentiality, which I respected then, I respect now. However, I think it's fine if names and details are changed to talk about it, because it's a way of opening a window into the terrible situation of the prison system.
And so go on, talk about it and tell us some of the most terrible ones.
You know, someone confessed to me that he'd probably killed someone. He'd been involved in a fight. See, this is the interesting thing, is I only had their words. If you imagine, I'm in a room, you know, a small room, me and this person for an hour. It is the most intense experience you can imagine, because it's just the two of you. You've never met them before. And you've only got their words. So I can't fact check anything. I'm certainly not going to start challenging them. A little bit in some ways, but I'm not going to sit there and go, itchy chin, bollocks. You know, do you know what I mean? I'm there to believe them and to listen to them. And that's it. So
the one with the guy saying he killed someone, was there any more detail on
yes,
that?
Yes, no, there was. So he had been involved in a fight with a couple of lads. A knife had been involved and he had stabbed one of them. And he says he was walking home with his girlfriend and they jumped him and he was protecting her. You heard this a lot. The people always paint themselves in this very chivalrous position that might not stand up to sort of CCTV evidence. But, you know, I always say to them, look, I'm not the judge. I'm not the jury. You can tell me what you want. I'm not going to sort of send you to prison for this. And so anyway, he stabbed someone and then he found that this person was on life support. And then he then heard that they're probably going to have to switch to life support off. So what he thought was a run-of-the-mill stabbing, which, by the way, once you've been in Wandsworth for 6 months, you hear about stabbings are like, you know, common or gone, was going to turn into something much more serious. And I was kind of intrigued. And I remember saying to him, what did you do with the murder weapon? I was trying to like think through it, almost like his lawyer. I don't know why, but I was like, okay, because he was really worried he was going to get done. He was really worried he was going to get lifed off. Like for that, he's looking at 20 years. None of this get out at half time. 20 years, time done. You will be a middle-aged man. He was quite young by the time he got out. So he was terrified. And that's why he'd called a listener. So I was kind of going, well, let's just talk through the situation, because that's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to ask probing, open-ended questions to get it all out there. And also, I was bloody curious. So he said, from memory, he'd got rid of the knife, and I went, good. And he said, so the only thing that could tie me to it were the jeans I was wearing on the night. And I said, well, where are they? And he said, well, I didn't want to throw them away. They're really good jeans. So I was wearing them when I was arrested, and they're here. They're in the prison.
Oh.
They're here in the prison.
Oh, my God.
And I was like, dude, you've got to throw these away. But then I was like, well, hang on. Am I helping a murderer escape here? There's all sorts of ethical lines being crossed here. But he because he was a child, and he said, no, but they're really good jeans. Like, dude, you're going to get 20 years. That's the thing that you always remember. They're not master criminals. They're all a bit dim, the people who commit these crimes.
In a circumstance like that, you've been given no advice whether you should pass this information on to authorities. You're just...
No, I don't have to. I don't have to.
You don't have to, no.
The legal position is, if there's... Which is never going to happen. It's only if you think a terrorist attack is about to happen. That's a weird thing. That's the weird thing. Then I have to go and call the police.
I was going
to
say, when you say, what did you do with the murder weapon, is a real big cue.
Yeah. but if you think about a prison listener, you're in a prison, like everyone in that place has probably done something pretty wrong. And you're listening to people all day, every day. So if you say, oh, no, I can't listen to anything to do with crime, it's like, well, go home, because you're going to hear that a lot.
Is there any sort of like CCTV in the cell when this stuff's happening? I mean, is this stuff being recorded? It's not being recorded.
God, No. Lots of people thought I was recording them, because a lot of people are suffering from psychosis. And that's a classic thing. People with schizophrenia and spawn psychosis, that is this being recorded? There's bugs. MI5 are bugging us. And I'm like, dude, you know, you're in for carjacking. MI5 have got a lot. don't get carried away with a sense of self-importance here. I don't think MI5 give a shit about what car you've stolen. I'm just going to put that out there.
You did record prisoners when you were researching the material for Time After Time.
Yes. Yeah. And well, that came from a podcast I did.
Yeah.
So I did a podcast, got a bit of a stretch, which was after I got out, I was like, I've heard so many mad stories as a listener, but just, you know, just being a prisoner for 2.5 years, this is going to be a great documentary. And then the documentary dies on its ass because none of them wanted to go on camera because back to the stigma we were talking about at the start, no one wanted to be identified. So I listened to a great podcast series called Ear Hustle, which is American prisoners, actually in San Quentin prison, prisoners interviewing prisoners. It's phenomenal. So I listened to that and I went, oh, I know, I'll do a podcast. So I recorded people who I'd met inside in all stage of the process, either the first week or the last week, or people I shared cells with or whatever. And I said, look, I'm going to record your voice. I'm going to change your name, but I want your story and your voice to be real. I got like 20 people to do it. And when the podcast came out, I was messaging people saying, oh, the podcast came out. We got a great review in the Times. And I was getting one grey tick showing that the message hadn't even been received. And one grey tick for criminal people means back inside. Well, you know, I'd get messages from their wives or their brothers or whatever going, oh, no, sorry, it's just got another 6 years or whatever. I came out not never speeding again. Like, you know, I'm so overly, painfully law-abiding because I never want to go back. But all these people ended up going back. So it's like, well, why is that? Why do people go round and round the cycle of reoffending?
And the reason is because...
it's all the systems and structures that are and were in place to stop people reoffending are now either not there or have become so kind of twisted by defunding that they're actually now pushing people back into prison. You walk out of prison with an invisible tentacle around your ankle and it is just pulling and pulling and pulling and it will get you back one day.
So how confessional did jail make you, Chris? Was there something you wanted to get off your chest when you were in there?
Yes, definitely. I found it almost like I was being pushed down by a lot of pressure. A, because there was my own situation. I had a four-year-old son at home who I was missing terribly. I thought my whole life and career was going up shit creek. And I was hearing all this really mad, traumatic stuff. And I was seeing a lot of self-harm. I was seeing a lot of blood through my role as a listener. So there was a lot that was kind of coming down on me. So the only way I could really deal with it myself was just talking a lot to my cellmates. And I would write letters to all my friends or to anyone who wrote to me. I would always write back. And I kept my diary. So my diary was, at the peak of my listening, was 6 A4 pages a day I was writing. It was crazy block capital letters because I hadn't written handwritten for years. So everything was in capitals, oddly. And I've still got these notes, and it does look like the scrawlings of a madman. But I found that was almost like automatic. So it was kind of confessional, but on the page. And I always say to people, if you're going through a very traumatic time, just write everything down. And you could burn it afterwards. Doesn't matter. You don't have to publish it or show it to anyone. But just that process I found, like, and that just reduced the pressure. And then it would build up again. And then it would reduce. But yeah, my cellmates were absolutely fundamental. I know that because the darkest times I had when I was in prison was when I was at open prison. So after Wandsworth, away from all the madness, no self-harm, nothing bad happens at open prison except the server runs out of chips. It's very, very boring. And that's when I got my most sort of bad mental health problems. And it was because I was in a room on my own and didn't have anyone to talk to.
Just some confessions that caught our eyes. Just some confessions that caught our eyes.
Hey, Chris, before you leave us, there's something I'd like you to do. We've got a big grab bag of confessions that mention prison. I'm going to read them out. Dave's going to read some out, and we'd like you to react.
Go on.
I worked in prison 20 years ago. Part of the job was to count in and out cutlery from the kitchen. After one shift, I got a call from prison to check if I'd taken a fork home. I said no, and the whole wing was shut down and all cells searched. Fork found later in my trousers.
I can believe that. The joke is if a mouse farts, they'll shut down the wing. And then that's a whole day when people aren't getting any exercise. They aren't going to do their education. They're not doing their drug therapies. They're not going to go and see their wife or visit or whatever. So they didn't need much to shut something down. I don't know how old that is because actually all cutlery in prison is plastic.
Wait a minute. It opened with I worked in prison 20 years ago.
It was 20 years ago, yes. I think that could be it.
But defending the
sorry,
truth. That's
I mean,
all here.
I'm sorry. But the I once shared one of the last cellmates I had was the worst one actually, and he had got done for stabbing someone. He got 8 extra years on his sentence because he stabbed someone in the neck with a plastic prison knife.
Oh.
And I couldn't even cut an orange. I couldn't peel an orange with these knives. They were so blunt. They were so not sharp. When I got out, I looked it up and I saw the offence and he managed to ram it in the net. And the guy didn't die. Amazingly, he got in his neck. He told me that while he was holding the knife as well, Victoria. It wasn't like threatening me or anything, but I was just like,
like, change yourself, the last please. Thing I did with a knife like this.
Yeah, no, it was, that was probably fucking terrifying.
Okay, I'll read another one. I work for the prison service, and most officers are, if not more, manipulative, selfish, and difficult as the prisoners.
I mean, I didn't find that, I have to say. I always do try and fly a flag for the officers. But there were some that were awful people. And I think as well, the job kind of does crush the humanity out of you a bit, because if you feel everything and you're truly empathetic all the time, you're not going to get the job done, because there isn't time to be nice to everyone or even just be a human being to everyone. So I did see people change. People turned up and they would be really, really nice at first, but over the months they would start becoming harsher and harsher just because they just couldn't get through the day if they were just going to, you know, be a human being all the time.
Yeah, a friend of mine used to have this theory about how the NHS could turn liberals into fascists.
Yeah.
I'm a prison officer, and I had one prisoner who I didn't like, who had three women on the go. At Christmas, while reading the mail, I swapped the cards around he was sending out to them, so they got each other's instead of their own. His next three visits were over very quickly.
That's brilliant. I mean, I certainly was aware of that, of guys who had several women on the go and were trying to spin those plates while they're in prison. And from memory, I can remember a couple of times where it did come unstuck because they saw who was down to visit, or they just didn't cover their tracks very well. But it was like there's no shortage of women who wanted to date guys in prison. That's the other thing that I found very odd. So I thought it would be a massive turnoff, but I think certain women...
You go, well, I got...
Well, no, I mean, I don't want to get too much into my private life, but it does, there's certain people who do find it, like, quite attractive.
Yeah.
But they're not maybe the kind of people you want to be in a relationship with.
It was that scene in Cracker, wasn't it, where Jimmy McGovern talking through the character of Cracker and talking about how the brilliant casting of Dirty Den was that guy was had been in prison for murder, and it meant that everyone was just like, whoa.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the weird thing with the murderers were interesting because they were often quite old. Because I normally only saw them in an open prison. They've been in a very long time. They're coming towards the end of their sentence. So I did get to know quite a few murderers, but a lot of them were old men. They came across as like someone's granddad. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't here's someone with an axe going to kill you. It's here's someone who might need some help crossing the road.
I went to prison for a month. No one knew apart from my best mate. Everyone else thought I'd gone travelling for a month. He wrote to my parents a few times to show them photos of my travels I'd sent him on WhatsApp. They are none the wiser to this day.
It does ring true, doesn't it, from what you were saying earlier?
Yeah, I think it's just the shame element of it. Because at least with me, it's like I talk about, hey, I come on podcasts and talk about my time in prison. So I don't walk around with that feeling of being found out, which people must have, because I had that during the case. Because I was basically told, like, do not, for all sorts of reasons, do not talk publicly about this case. I didn't want people to know that I was going to go on trial for tax fraud. So I kind of kept it to myself. And I was always worried that people would find out. Like, I remember very specifically whenever my phone rang and it was a withheld number, I would think, that's the Daily Mail. They know. I was so glad when that stopped. And so that's why I'm not shouting about it from the rooftop, but to have that, I can empathise with that feeling of someone's going to find out. Are they going to find out? Are they going to find out? Are they going to find out? And that is actually really, really kind of crushing and toxic and unfair. It'd be so nice for that guy to be able to say, look, Mum, Dad, I went to prison. I'm just telling you this now so I can just stop worrying about you finding out. But that's the world we live in, where people think that, you know, with some justification, that it, you know, means that people are going to think less of them because of it.
I'm a prison officer, and I love it when I can smell weed on the landings. It chills the aggressive little knobheads out, and the smell takes me right back to the great times I had getting stoned in the 90s.
I saw that one. That was on my list as well. Okay, so that speaks to something really interesting, that one, and it rings so true because so many prison officers will have that similar sentiment that, God, wasn't life easier when they all smoked weed? So this is all about the law of unintended consequences. People would go to prison, and they would smoke dope. That was just what they did. And that was like in the sort of maybe sort of the 90s and the 2000s. They would sit on the beds and they'd smoke dope. Now, confession, I used to smoke marijuana when I was younger. And I'd just sit around and sleep for 12 hours a day and laugh at the telly. That was like, you know, it doesn't make you a violent individual. Problem was, is then there was a lot of negative press about, oh, prisoners are all taking drugs, prisoners are taking drugs. So they brought in mandatory drug testing, MDTs, piss tests. Okay. Now, one of the things scientifically, this is true about marijuana, is it stays in the system for a very long time. You could smoke marijuana, 3 weeks later do a piss test, and you're going to get found out. But then other drugs owe the system for a lot less time. So prisoners started diverting to other drugs to beat the piss test. One of those is heroin. Obviously, heroin is at the other end of the scale of harm to marijuana, but goes out of the system pretty quick. Cocaine, pretty quick. So those drugs started being taken. And then along comes spice, which is a synthetic form of cannabis. It's a cannabinoid. There's a lot of news about it. One of the reasons that spice is so popular in prison, so I was chatting to a friend the other day, and he's inside, and he said literally every single person in prison is on spice, is because it doesn't show up on drug tests, because they can keep changing the formula. So it doesn't smell. Sniffer dogs can't get it. It doesn't show up on drug tests. It's very, very easy to smuggle it. You can smuggle it in a million different ways. And it's very easy to make. You can make it at home on your radiator.
Sorry, you can make spice at home on your radiator?
Yeah, with the right chemicals. People make it in their garages, okay.
Okay.
Very cheap and easy to make. And it's very, very, very profitable to sell in prisons. Spice, unfortunately, does terrible things to you that traditional old school cannabis does not. People have spice attacks. People collapse, trigger psychosis. People become violent. You see it like the images that come out of prisons of people on spice, and it's absolutely terrifying. It's like the zombie drug. So that has created a whole new set of problems in prison, but it was much, much better when people just smoke weed all the time.
That I was kind of being a bit sceptical about some of that, just because some of it seems to be like a moral panic in the press about it, but is it that bad?
Oh, spice is absolutely horrendous. Like, I wouldn't touch it. I would see people collapse on it. You'd hear people collapse on it. You'd be walking on the landing, you'd hear someone collapse, bang. There was a guy who was called Spice Attack because he had so many spice attacks. They'd come out with defibrillators, dude, you know, clear, all that stuff. Regular basis. It is absolutely terrible what that stuff does to people.
Anana pin. I've got one from our sister Twitter account, Anonopin, the account that publishes anonymous opinions. Most of you would love prison so you could do gay sex and pretend it's not something that you're actually into, it's just circumstance.
Didn't see any of it. And I think that it's one of those prison myths that you get from popular culture and films and maybe Shawshank or whatever. And I'm not saying it didn't happen in those in kind of environments that they're portraying, but certainly in the British prison system, they're quite homophobic. Prison is, you know, there's very, very toxic male environment. So I think if you came on someone in the shower, you might regret it.
It'd be I suppose it'd be interesting to ask a gay person in that circumstance, because there's a whole little world of communication. You might not be in tune with.
But I knew some gay people. I knew some gay people. There was a guy who I just, you know, my gaydar's okay. So open prison, there was a guy who was gay, and I kind of spotted it because he was very, very careful. He was talking about his partner, and it was always, and the way he was on the phone when you'd walk past, he would always get very, very quiet when you walk past. Didn't want people to know that he was talking to a guy when he was saying, I love you and stuff like this. And you could tell he was telling me, quite rightly, he kept it very, very quiet. He was terrified that people would find out.
Yeah, well, actually, I had a question. I seem to remember reading that you actually edited one of your films while you were in prison. Is that true at all?
That is true. So that's when I was at open prison. And open prison is not like a normal prison. Open prisons are like shit butlins. And there's like two officers on duty at any time.
Shit.
People would get pizzas delivered there. I mean, it's a bit of a joke. And the whole point is they put people there and see if you can handle the sort of the increased freedom, you know. And I would go out. I'd be out the grounds for 12 hours a day. I did a degree down at Oxford Brookes. I went to Oxford Brookes every day and did a degree.
You finished a degree in that circumstance?
Yeah, I did a degree in psychology.
Wow.
So, and I edited a film and I wrote my book and I got loads done. It was one of the most productive times of my life. I wasn't drinking because they breathalyze you. So I didn't drink. I wasn't taking drugs, didn't smoke. Then I did get quite thick. So I'd run around. There was a big field out the back of Oxford Brookes called South Park, funnily enough. So I'd run around that a few times a day. So I did get very fit, got tanned and got tons of work. No social media, not supposed to go to social media, which I could have got away with, but I just thought, sod it. I don't want to be seeing tweeting because people are going to go, hey, aren't you supposed to be in prison? And, you know, I'll be found out. So I didn't look at Twitter. I got tons done.
That almost sounds like a recommendation, except that you also said it was one of the most psychologically dark times.
It was. So I became a massive recluse. I did a lot of good work, but I wasn't talking to anyone. I'd go to Oxford Brookes and I was seen as a mature student. And I wasn't going around saying, hey, kids, I'm from the prison down the road. So they just thought I was just, they had mature students there. So they just thought I was just some older guy. And I just sat quietly in the back and gone with my work and didn't really talk to anyone. And then I'd go back to prison, I didn't really talk to anyone. So yeah, I just kind of just got quite, hermit-like.
Great. Thank you very much, Chris. Your little plug for all your stuff is...
Oh, so I did my plug. So I wrote a book about my time in prison, which is called A Bit of a Stretch, which was the Sunday Times bestseller in 2020, but you've paperback for that. It's doing the rounds. And then I interviewed lots of ex-prisoners about their time in prison for my podcast series, which is also called A Bit of a Stretch. And then because a lot of those guys went back inside, I thought, what is so wrong about the system that means people get stuck on the reoffending cycle? We have such high levels of recidivism. So I wrote another book, which is called Time After Time, which is out a couple of months ago. Basically, me following the stories of some very, very, very bad criminals who basically can't stay out of prison. So it's dark and funny, but also there's a bit of an investigation there into why the system keeps sucking people back to jail.
And to finish on a nice note, Fesol isn't just horror. It could be really quite silly. Here's one that I pulled out this week I quite liked. Started amusing myself in work meetings by adding no pun intended after comments I make with absolutely no pun or double meaning in them. Then I spend the next 5 minutes watching people's faces as they're clearly trying to work out what the pun is. Bye. Bye. Goodbye. No pun intended.
Since recording this episode, we've had a new Labour government voted in, and there's a new prison minister appointed, businessman James Timpson. And there's been a lot of excitement about this because of Timpson's long work in helping improve the outcome of ex-prisoners by giving them work in his key-cutting and cobbling shops. We thought we'd ask Chris Atkins for his reaction, and he sent this voice note.
So, yeah, one of the biggest surprises about the Labour landslide victory last week was... the way that prisons rocketed really to the top of the agenda, which wasn't a surprise because there were some news stories circulating the week before that the civil service had compiled what they called a black swan list for the incoming Labour government, which is basically the most extreme and serious pressing problems that they were going to have to deal with. When they took the keys of government, and prisons were right at the top of the list because they are literally so jam-packed, they can't put another criminal in them. And you got the feeling that the Tories were basically quite pleased to be elected out of office because they weren't actually going to have to deal with it. And so when Keir Starmer took office, and there was a blizzard of announcements of politicians getting into cabinet positions, a lot of it not surprisingly at all because they'd all been shadow ministers for many, many months. But the one that made everyone's head do a handbrake turn was James Timpson being put in charge of Ministry of Prisons. And he wasn't even a politician. So he's been made, he's not an MP. So he's been made a member of the House of Lords. And if you're a member of the House of Lords, you can be in government. So he's gone from being a guy who runs a key shop to being in charge of the prison system. And it's not as mad as it sounds because Timpson is a bit of a legend in prison reform circles because he insists on employing prisoners and in some cases serving prisoners because he thinks it's a wonderful piece of sort of social contribution that his company can make because prisoners who leave custody and go into a job are far, far less likely to commit crimes. And he also finds prisoners in his workforce very, very loyal and very hardworking. And he's really blazed a trail and made it kind of publicly acceptable to employ criminals. So because of him, other big employers like McDonald's and Pret-a-Manger and Iceland now employ people straight out of prison, and it's having a huge positive impact. And it was particularly strange for me because in my book, Time After Time, I have a list of recommendations at the end of the book to say, here's how the prison system should be made to be improved. And one of my recommendations, you can get the book and read this, and it came out like 9 months ago, said, hire James Timpson into government and make him in charge of prison and rehabilitation. And that's exactly what Keir Starmer's done. So I was absolutely thrilled when that happened. And I think it's a signal that the Labour government is hopefully not going to be quite so aggressive and judgmental and punishment obsessed as the last few governments have been when it comes to prisons, and it means that they're going to have more evidence-based, practical, rational policies that are going to lift people out of crime and stop them reoffending rather than kicking them so hard that all they can do is go back to crime. So, yeah, I was absolutely thrilled when Timpson was given the job, and I think it's a positive sign of things to come.
Maybe things are looking up. Toodle pip. Thanks, Chris. That was a party political broadcast on behalf of Ed Davey and his watery stunts. I nearly said watery shits then.